Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Rich Eisen Show.
What is your nickname, Tavondre?
Live from the Rich Eisen Show studio in Los Angeles.
Shout out to my grandma, Miss Ebony. She named me Meatloaf.
The Meatloaf!
What do you think? Wouldn't that be great if that's the way you're introduced in the NFL? Wouldn't that be great?
I would love it.
The Meatloaf!
The Rich Eisen Show. Earlier on the show, ESPN investigative reporter Tisha Thompson. Coming up, Chairman and CEO of Wasserman Media Group, Casey Wasserman. 2024 NFL Draft prospect Darius Robinson. And now it's Rich Eisen.
What a wild conversation we had in hour number one of the investigative reporter from ESPN, Tisha Thompson, who broke the Shohei Ohtani interpreter gambling stuff. I mean, just wild. That just leaves only more questions still to come. 844-204-RICH is the number to dial here on the Rich Eisen Show, live on the Roku channel here in Los Angeles, California. We're free on every Roku device known to man because the Roku channel is free. Select Samsung Smart TVs, Amazon Fire TV. The Roku app has the Roku channel on it, and the RokuChannel.com for the internet users out there. We're free on that as well. We say hello to our terrestrial radio audience. We say hello to SiriusXM and Odyssey streaming us live. And then, of course, just because you podcasters listen to us whenever you want, you podcast listeners, we say hello to you if you're listening to this show all 3 hours every single day. Thrilled to have sitting here right here is somebody I'm also thrilled to call a friend. This man had me and Suze to a dinner party literally 3 weeks after we moved to Los Angeles, California. So I've known him for 21 plus years. Good to see the chairman and CEO of Wasserman, Casey Wasserman, right here. How are you, Casey?
Good to see you.
I'm great, man.
Did you ever think that the 40 meter dash thing would be your logo like that?
I did never think in a million years me running a 40-yard dash in my suit at the combine would grow into all sorts of things. And then, you know, we're having our 20th run. I'm doing my 20th run, but we're having the fundraiser for St. Jude coming up at the Rose Bowl.
Well, there you go.
So if you're in town, man,
okay,
come on out.
Olympic soccer finals will be at the Rose Bowl.
I love it.
Yeah.
I mean, you must be genuinely excited to have the Olympics here in this town. How did that all come about? I know that's why you're laughing. It's such a macro story.
I laugh. Well, look, the mayor of LA at the time, Eric Garcetti, who's now the ambassador to India.
Right.
Unbeknownst to truly everybody.
Right.
On his first day in office, sent a letter to the U.S. Olympic Committee saying, if you ever compete or bid for the Olympics, I'm throwing LA's hat in the ring. Mm-hmm. And didn't tell his staff. I mean, not that he should have told me, but friends, whatever.
Right.
And, you know, 6 or 8 months later, they decide to evaluate whether they should bid, because you remember they lost in 12 in New York, 2016 Chicago. Mm-hmm. They took the 2020 bid off because they were so dismayed that they essentially got first round eliminated for both those bids. Mm-hmm. And they're like, okay, we got to try this again. And so they ran this process, and he asked me, hey, I have a bid. We need a CEO. Do you have any ideas? I gave him a few friends who are at the end of their careers or retired or in between jobs, would be good for like a 6 month project to go put a bid together. Mm-hmm. And I said, but by the way, this is a terrible idea because we're going to lose. Like, the IOC does not love America, generally speaking, mm-hmm. just for the record. So, mm-hmm. bad idea, but here's some people. Calls me back a few weeks later and says, you know, why don't you do this? I said, well, first of all, in case you forgot, it's a bad idea. And second of all, I have a job, so I'm good. Like, mm-hmm. and then a month later, he goes, I hate to do this to you, but I'm the mayor and you have to do this. And I said, well, in case you forgot, this is a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. And it just proves the old adage that you can't win if you don't play the game. And so,
got to be in it to win it.
You do. And so we started this process. And the one thing we committed to each other was that we were going to do it our way authentically. We weren't going to try and pretend to be stuffy Europeans. We were just two young, relatively young guys from LA. Mm-hmm. We were going to be authentically LA, embrace that we're a different kind of American city, and just compete. And started against Rome, Hamburg, Budapest, and Paris. And lo and behold, Hamburg first, then Rome, and then Budapest all dropped out for different reasons. Left with LA and Paris, and I had come up with this idea in that time zone, which mm-hmm. was like, Paris would have lost, one of two things was certain to happen in 2024 bidding. Paris would have lost four consecutive bids, mm-hmm. or the three largest cities in America would have lost three consecutive bids. And if you're the IOC, those are one of those two things happening is a bad result. And so I said, just give us each a games. Like, it's not like there's a list of 100 people who want these things. These are two incredible global cities. This is like declare victory from the jaws of defeat.
Right.
Not how they normally do things, but lo and behold, the more you talk about it, the more they think about it, the more they understand it. And so what started with a crazy idea became a reality in September 2017. And here we are, some 1,570 days away from opening ceremonies in L.A.
And so that's why it's Paris this summer and Los Angeles?
And it was this, you know, dance of who was going to go when. We were always happy to go in 2028 because the risk of time, if you're building things, is construction things escalate and expenses escalate. We have nothing to build permanently here. So time just allowed us to generate more revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And think about what's happened in the interim since we got the games in 2017. SoFi opened, Intuit opened, massive renovation of the Coliseum, massive renovation of crypto. Dodgers obviously have changed. Like
the Rose Bowl is doing some renovations too.
Like LA has changed dramatically. And right. So even by 2028, just on the non-facility side, all the infrastructure, airport, all those things. So we're really lucky to, and I didn't obviously know COVID was going to happen, so I'm glad I didn't have to try and generate revenue during COVID.
Right.
And lo and behold, you know, 2028 is coming fast, and on October 11th, we'll take the flag in Paris, literally take the Olympic flag, and then we're next.
And then bring it.
We bring it home the next morning. Okay. We will hang it in City Hall, and then when we're done, we'll give it to Brisbane.
Wow. So where, what in the world? So the opening ceremonies are at SoFi?
The opening ceremonies, the traditional parade of athletes is at SoFi.
Yes.
We will go through the Coliseum because it's important to recognize the history of that venue.
Of course.
But the technology you need to produce an opening ceremonies for television,
yes,
and infrastructure and sound and stuff, if you will,
yes,
you can't do it at the Coliseum without spending hundreds of millions of dollars.
But are you going to bring you're going to light the torch there, though?
We haven't decided because it's a weird thing. It's never usually two torch lit, so we haven't quite figured that out. We're going to have to build a cauldron somewhere else because the actual lighting of the torch will be at SoFi. The question is, do we light the
Susie and I would give our backyard if you want. I mean, yeah. just
I was actually thinking
about,
you know, spacesuit guy, whatever he did in 84, you could like recreate that thing, right?
Sure. I'm with you. You, whatever you need, Casey.
All right.
Whatever
I love
you
that.
Need, man. My backyard, you know, for a cauldron.
Athletics will be at the Coliseum, though. So we will build a track at the Coliseum and it's going to be spectacular.
So old school, man.
Old school.
Just like that.
Old school.
And then the Rose Bowl has
Rose Bowl will have soccer finals and semifinals. The challenge is when you,
yes,
as I remind people, the World Cup's coming to America in 2026.
Oh my gosh.
Which is nice, but as I say, that's a little boutique event. We have 36 sports in the Olympics, right? 36 sports.
Yes.
We will produce a men's and a women's World Cup as one of our 36 events.
Hmm.
So we actually can't play more than the semis and the finals because we've got semifinals and finals, men's and women's. So you got two games on each side. Finals, two games, and then you got a bronze medal game, so you go back and play it. So you have seven games, essentially, in 5 days. It's almost, might be too much for the field.
Jeez, where's the Olympic Village going to be?
UCLA.
Hey.
So we will move. The great thing is we will move 20,000 students out of UCLA,
Come on.
June 1st.
Yeah.
And then we will move 20,000 athletes in probably July 1st.
So somebody's taking their finals, right?
Yep.
Theoretically. Then they have to pack up.
Yep.
And then so some like sophomore in their dorm room, they do their finals, they pack up, and then one of the top athletes in the
world will be sleeping in that room. And then we got to get out so that they can start school again.
That's right.
I mean, the science, everyone's like, why is opening ceremonies July 14th, 2028?
Yeah.
It is Bastille Day. There's no that's a fluke.
Okay.
Because if you just draw the line from when UCLA ends and USC starts, it's the only time we can fit the Olympics and the Paralympics and get in and out between those two universities because they are the key to our delivery is USC and UCLA.
Damn.
Yeah.
I'll just go personally here. I hope you don't mind, but what would your grandfather think of this, man? The great Lou Wasserman. What would he think of this right now?
I think he'd be very proud that this is public service to me. Like I'm
sure.
Giving back to the city I was born in and loved. The city loves the Olympics, and if we do this right, we can truly change this city forever. And I think LA is one of the two or three most important cities in the world. And so my ability to use my skill set, look, I could not do this job in any other city in America.
Yeah.
And I couldn't do this job if my day job wasn't my day job. So I'm like lucky that I have that day job and I live in Los Angeles. Because if this Olympics were in New York, obviously, it's a different perspective, right? We're not building things. This is not a construction project. This is a commercial project.
Right.
So my day job and my city are allowing me this opportunity. And so I'm willing to do this and work hard and have two jobs, essentially. And I think he'd be very proud because the legacy of the games won't be buildings. The legacy of the games will be an incredible human impact that we could have for generations.
Yeah. And I guess if it was New York, you'd include New Jersey. Are there how far out are we going out of town for some of these events?
Things like soccer prelims will play up and down the state for sure. Mm-hmm.
Even Northern California, yeah, you're talking about?
Well, you probably use mostly MLS stadiums in the state because there's so many games that you'll have to play.
Sure.
We're going to move a couple events out of the state of California, which we'll announce here in the next month or so.
Okay. Is there like a sub-bidding process for that sort of thing?
There's a few sports where you have to build a temporary facility, which is expensive and doesn't have a lot of legacy use. Mm-hmm. That other places in the country have world-class facilities, so to be able to go use those facilities as is. Mm-hmm. You know, it sounds crazy because this country's so big, but we're unique in LA, but think about in Paris, like you can't sail in Paris. So sailing's in Marseille. Marseille is an hour and 45 minute plane flight from Paris.
Right.
So that Paris is a small country relatively, but an hour and 45 plane flight from LA, you get to a lot of places to do another event. So it's not a crazy thing. It just sounds crazy because you're in a different state and it sounds different.
Like Colorado, you're saying something like, I want to put words
in. Not quite Colorado, maybe a little further, maybe, but really? Like in Paris, they're doing surfing in Tahiti. French Polynesia.
Okay.
So we are not surfing in Hawaii.
That is the follow-up right there.
Yes, it is the follow-up. But funny enough, in the summer, there's not great waves in Hawaii. So we'll be surfing in Southern California.
There are some great beaches here in Southern California.
For you, I think you should call flag football in the Olympics. I mean, come on.
Listen, that's a Mark Lazarus question, right? You know what I mean? And a Roger Goodell question.
I mean, come on.
But they are partners.
Partners.
We could put all of us
How
in a room.
How great would that be? It's going to be awesome for flag football.
That, I know the league is fired.
They're fired up. And you know that in 1932, it wasn't flag football. It was American football. They didn't have other countries, but they had four north, east, and south.
Yes.
Team playing 11-on-11 football, and like Pop Warner was one of the coaches of the 1932 Olympics. It was a demonstration sport in 1932.
Well, I know a ton of NFL players have said they want to do this.
Oh, it's crazy. Like,
you know,
it's crazy how excited they are.
You know, like I'm just wondering how many guys, because I mean, it would be during training camp, right? Wouldn't it be? Potentially
just at the beginning. Yeah, I mean, just about when training camps open.
So it would kind of work.
Yeah.
Like, let's see.
Non-contact, right?
2028, too. Like, we're talking 4 years from now. So so you'd be up for that, I imagine, right?
I think it's awesome. Look, the NFL, there's no way they're, and Roger, the commissioner, said this, there's no way they're not going to let their players play because they all want to do it. I mean, I've run into a bunch of NFL players like, even if I'm retired, I'm coming back. Like, it's crazy.
I love that.
Yeah.
Terrific. Casey Wasserman is here, chairman and CEO of Wasserman, talent representation, marketing, sales, rights, hospitality, all sorts of stuff to talk about. But when we come back, I want to talk about college athletics with you, since obviously you are quite involved with the UCLA athletic program, and just you've got some boots on the ground. I can't wait to have this conversation with Casey Wasserman when we come back right here on the Rich Eisen Show. 844-204-RICH, number to dial right here on this busy Thursday.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a
likelihood. So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Back here on the Rich Eisen Show, 844-204-RICH, number to dial, the Roku channel. We're back on the air. Radio will rejoin us in a couple minutes' time. What's the one aspect of sports, Casey, that you're surprised is an actual, like, televisable sport that you're like, you can't believe? Or an event. It could be an event. It could be anything that you can't believe.
I could offend a lot of friends of probably both of ours, but pickleball I don't understand as a televised sport because people... I think I have a fan in the room. People confuse, just because people play a sport doesn't mean people want to watch people play a sport.
Right.
And the reason so many people play pickleball is because it's accessible. It's not that technical. So,
Do you play it?
No. But watching, I mean, I have played, but watching pickleball on TV and these leagues is like, it's one of those things where like people are so desperate to own a league or own something or create something new. Yes. It's like they forget the kind of the fundamentals of like, it's not actually that interesting to watch. And therefore it's not actually a good business.
I haven't really watched it.
Well, you're lucky.
No, I play it. I play it. I enjoy it very much. They don't have like a kitchen cam. They don't have like, there's no ways to spice it up.
No,
but
you can play it. You can play with Suze. You can play. It's fun. It's easy. Yes. It's accessible. It's a pretty even playing field.
Yes.
Which is why it's so popular.
Correct.
But that doesn't mean it's a sport you want to.
It's also popular with like chiropractors.
Oh, my God.
And physical therapists.
100%.
I know some physical therapists say that pickleball is their number one multiplier of their business.
It's like when everyone was into CrossFit for a while and everyone was blowing their backs out. But it's like pickleball's the new version.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So Casey Wasserman, scratch pickleball off the list. take care of that. 844-204-RICH, number to dial. We mentioned we're right here live on the Roku channel, and the Rich Eisen Show radio audience is returning to us right now. Back on the Rich Eisen Show radio network, sitting at the Rich Eisen Show desk, furnished by Grainger, with supplies and solutions for every industry. Grainger has the right product for you. Call clickgrainger.com or just stop by. I figured Casey wouldn't mind me selling some soap right here. Casey Wasserman, chairman and CEO of Wasserman, right here on the Rich Eisen Show. So I cannot believe we're in Big Ten country. It just blows my mind that we are sitting here in Big Ten country. Why are we sitting here in Big Ten country? Why do you think UCLA and USC leaving for the Big Ten, and then we all know Oregon and Washington joining after that? Why did that happen?
Because what has happened is the difference between the haves and the have-nots got so severe economically that you either are, which is what you're going to see, or as you're on the verge of happening, you're in the Big Ten or the SEC, and to be clear, the Big 12 and the ACC are at least a step down. And if you're not in that ecosystem, you might as well play, and there's nothing wrong with it, but you're playing Ivy League sports. No scholarships, more than club, less than big boy football and all the other D1 sports, because USC and UCLA's economics, day one of this Big Ten calendar year, is incremental $40 million of revenue by doing nothing other than switching a conference.
That's it.
Just by going from the Pac-12 to the Big Ten, they will get an extra $40 million a year. And what people miss is, so yes, we can talk about NIL, and that's a big piece of this. Mm-hmm. But the other part about the ecosystem is the coaches' salaries, the facilities, the infrastructure. By the way, what the women's softball coach makes, what's the baseball coach makes, there's so much money in the Big Ten and the SEC that it goes through the whole system. And you can't compete unless you're part of the system. So UCLA can pay our women's basketball coach, Corey Close, who's great. She can pay a lot of money. If she went to the SEC, she'd probably make 3X. Mm-hmm. So if you're not in the Big Ten, you're losing, and you just become essentially a developmental system for the Big Ten and the SEC. And as I like to say, it's not an accident that the Big Ten and the SEC look a whole lot like the AFC and the NFC.
Because that's where it's going.
100%.
I mean, it's going that way where because NIL is part of this, and so is transfer portal, and so is scheduling. It's all stuff that has no codified, writ large, coast to coast, everybody involved guidelines.
Correct.
There's no one governing body that has 100% everything locked in, where everybody's scheduling the same, everybody deals with NIL the same, everybody deals with transfer portal the same. And the reason why they don't deal with it the same is, as you said, there's haves and have-nots. And there's only one way for this to go, is that everybody who has the same issues financially and has the same standing financially will get together and figure out how to deal with all of this stuff themselves.
Correct.
And the question is, who is the entity that puts that thing together?
So the only
when?
The only entity with the ability, I'm not sure capable or qualified, but the ability is the federal government.
Well, that's not happening.
It takes national legislation, but here's the part people miss or underestimate. If you're a senator from Mississippi or Iowa, you kind of like the system the way it is. Are you really going to take away from yourself to prop up the Big 12 and the ACC and these other conferences to lift everybody? Or do you like winning the national championship every year or being in the having the SEC get in the Big 12 get a disproportionate share of income? You're asking people to be truly magnanimous for something that is truly local and parochial to their states and their environment. That's a hard thing to do, to get, you know, two senators from Georgia to say, yeah, we're going to take money away from the University of Georgia, who wins national championships, the pride of the state, and we're going to give it to Washington State.
Well, that's why the federal government can't be involved.
Correct.
I'm just saying that maybe it, the way that I look at it is the college football playoff system and who's involved and who's eligible to be one of these now, what is it, six seeds, I guess, that get byes because it's going to be 14 teams at some point. That's the edges of where now whoever's involved in that and is eligible to be a seed in that, we're forming who the haves are.
Correct.
And so the question is who is going to be the commissioner of something like this? And then what does it mean to make the players employees
correct
of this system, and what that means for amateurism and student athletes?
It's scary on a whole host of levels. And I think we're at this turning point, which is college football is absolutely the second most popular and valuable sport in America. It's not even a question. The question is, do they monetize that opportunity and keep all the money in college football and don't share? And sort of college football becomes its own entity away from the NCAA. So do Michigan basketball and UCLA basketball are part of the Big Ten, but college football is its own thing. There's Michigan is in that, but they don't really, it's not really a Big Ten thing. It's really just a college football thing. And then Michigan basketball and UCLA softball are over because there's no money. Because the money, 90% of the value in the economics come from college football.
Right.
Or do you keep them in the system and use that money to solve the problem? Because NIL is not fixing the problem. NIL has made the problem worse.
How so?
Well, you've just, NIL, well, and it's certainly with what's happened at Dartmouth with the unionization and what's happened in Tennessee where it's explicit pay for play. There are no rules. You can literally just pay for play. NIL is truly just pay for play. And where are you going to spend your money? You're going to spend money where you drive revenue, and you drive revenue in football. So you are just making the rich richer in that system. You know, I think the average NIL deal in the country is $500.
Is that right?
But Ohio State says it costs them $13 million a year to maintain their roster. I mean, Ryan Day says that publicly. That's not a secret. I can assure you, in terms of Title IX, he's not spending $13 million. Ohio State's not spending $13 million a year on their women's programs. And so it's just made college football way more outside the system. And the problem is all of our sports, that the Olympic sports, if you will, or basketball and all the Olympic sports only exist because football provides so much of the economics to subsidize those.
So why can't we connect what you and I are saying is inevitable to the rest of the collegiate athletic system that we all think is absolutely necessary to stay?
We have to. And that's, I think people need to understand.
Thus the commissioner. You got to get somebody who's figuring this stuff out. And I think we can agree. The NCAA ain't it, right?
They don't. They're not. They don't have the control or the purview, clearly, because it's very clear the conferences, commissioners at a minimum, and the university presidents are running the system. You have to keep the money in the system. And by the way, you can't have literally having athletes as employees is a scary proposition. So let's say the president of the University of Michigan, teachers are part of a union, the janitors, the workers, the staff are a union. The athletes are now a union. You got different unions. Let's say collective bargaining for Michigan football team, I'm certain they would say, well, we play Ohio State. We don't have to go to class that week. I mean, that's not an unreasonable work condition request. It's untenable for a university president to have students as employees. You can't have employees being taught by employees. It is truly, now I'm not saying that the system is appropriate without athletes getting some compensation. One, I think we're minimizing the value of education, right? So if you were an out-of-state student going to the University of Michigan, it's $80,000 a year for tuition. However, there's 3,000 freshmen or 4,000 freshmen, and there's probably 100 freshman student athletes. Those 3,900 others would probably do what the 100 have to do to get free education. So let's actually talk about how valuable education is, because most of these athletes aren't going to be professional athletes. So the education is a big value driver. We're talking as a country about spending $1 trillion to wipe out student debt, but we're now minimizing the value of education for the student athletes. It's a weird thing to be saying. And then let's create a system where they can earn money. I think the proper way to do it is on a much more level playing field, a transparent playing field, and a consistent playing field. And it accrues while you're a student. And when you leave, you get your money. But this transfer portal, unlimited free agent, no salary cap system doesn't work, because if it did, every league would operate that way. But it doesn't work because it runs amok. And so we got to get controls over the system. We have to remember that it is college sports. And by the way, in this country, all of our American athletes who are Olympians are trained in universities. So if we lose that system, we don't have Team USA anymore. Our athletes, our government does not provide funding to the U.S. Olympic movement. There's zero federal dollars go to any part of the U.S. Olympic movement. All of our athletes are trained in colleges. And that's a great source of pride, and that's going to evaporate.
Casey Wasserman here on the Rich Eisen Show. So we've established the fact that there's no rules for a lot of this stuff, or there are rules, they're not enforced. And, you know, NIL is definitely now being used more as an inducement, 100%. Which is not the reason why it's supposed to have existed.
Correct.
And then the transfer portal, it's nuts. It's nuts. You have to recruit your own players after you've recruited them.
Correct.
And it's also in collegiate basketball. It's open now during the NCAA tournament, which is nuts, right? Then there's scheduling where sometimes it's cupcake city, to use the Dick Vitale phrase. And so there's more for coaches to do, which is why, shall we say, some coaches just don't want to do it anymore.
No question.
And it seems like you at UCLA had that happen with Chip Kelly. Is that what happened?
100%. One, the challenge is, if you were hiring a head football coach today, that stuff is in your job description, right? You can't say, well, I don't like NIL, so I'm not going to deal with it. You can't. It is what it is today, and you have to deal with it if you're going to be a college football coach. He didn't like it. He didn't like the thing. He also didn't like the fact that, go back to the heyday of USC under Pete Carroll. Go back to Carson Palmer and Mark Sanchez and Matt Leinart, and he come in, you redshirt a year, you sit on the bench a year, and then you start. Quarterback after quarterback. In this day and age, if he's not starting as a freshman, they leave. Like, you're not developing players anymore. And Chip is an old school football coach who likes to develop players, and he lost that because he had to kowtow to players. We had Dante Moore. You know, he didn't play him. He wasn't ready to play, and so he left. Now, that may not be best for his career, but he has that freedom now, and I'm not sure what the long-term implications of that for. So Chip really just got fed up with the environment. The fact is, it's part of the job, so it is what it is. You know, it'll be interesting to see how long he stays at Ohio State as an offensive coordinator, because I'm sure he wants to, you know, continue to prove his ability to be a leader and to be a coach. But I think he just needed a reset for himself, and you can't, in this day and age, not dealing with that stuff is not optional.
Because before he left, he had a soliloquy from the podium about exactly what you and I have just spent the previous 10 minutes talking about, which is, like, separate football from the rest of everything else, let everybody else continue on in a more of a sensible regional setup, so UCLA golf doesn't have to go fly you know, three time zones to maybe play, and other so-called Olympic sports don't have to go and fly all over the place. So he kind of made a ton of sense right there, but then he just said he didn't want to do it anymore.
Coaches are talent too. So they all have their idiosyncrasies. And I just think that as the system got more and more out of control, because I think it is out of control, he got more and more frustrated by it. And he's an old school football coach who actually believes in structure and system, and he's got that military mindset, and he's just got, and it sort of, I think it was just creating a real internal struggle for him. And I don't, whether he left right or not, I just don't think it was making him enjoy his job in the way he wanted to enjoy it.
And obviously, if it's not the way, you don't want to coach there anyway. So Deshaun Foster, old school, right? He's a UCLA Bruin. What has impressed you about him? And again, I know you're not part of the administration.
No,
I get it.
Look, I mean, the football.
Your name's on a couple buildings.
My name's on the football building, so at least. But look, I'm super impressed with Deshaun because what he realized is, and most importantly, I think you've seen this in Michigan. Unlike some previous Michigan coaches, he wants to be the head coach of UCLA football. He's not being the head coach of UCLA football to go somewhere else. And he was there. He understands it. He believes in it. He's passionate about it. Mm-hmm. If you look at that video of when our athletic director introduced him and the team didn't know, I mean, if that doesn't make you have goosebumps or bring tears to your eyes, that the team jumped up, mobbed him, and by the way, the transfer portal opened 2 days later and not one player left. That tells you a lot about how connected he was to those kids. Mm. And so he's going to be a great CEO, head coach of UCLA football. He brings in Eric Bieniemy. He's kept our defensive coordinator. He's got a really good system. And he's like, look, we're going to recruit. We're going to be aggressive. And, you know, Chip had, I think, 5 scholarship offers for next year. Mm-hmm. That you can't. That's how he did at Oregon, though. He was selective and he got his guys. You can't do that in this day and age. You've got to be way more aggressive. And Deshaun's like, we're going to recruit everywhere. We're going to go be aggressive and get people to understand what we're doing and how we're doing it. And the energy he's brought, the engagement with the students he's brought, he's been awesome. And I think he understands what the job requires. He's got the ability to communicate and connect with the student athletes.
Yeah.
And he's got all the resources to be successful. This will be a difficult year because our first year in the Big Ten. But you know what? We've got 10 of our 11 offensive starters coming back. And you know what? Crazier things have happened. And that energy he's going to bring and that excitement is palpable.
Yeah, I mean, sure, you must have every piece of UCLA apparel that's ever been created. Do you have cold weather gear? Does it exist?
I think we have a little cold. I mean, we're ready.
Cold weather gear exist?
I think we're in Madison late in the year. It's going to be a little cold.
Okay.
Happy Valley, I'm not sure. Rutgers, you know, we've got a few cold weather games. But when you guys all come to the West Coast and it's hot and you're complaining and you're sweating, don't worry.
By the way, for the record, if I did pick up a slight in the Jim Harbaugh direction that I should know about coaches who don't want to be there and are looking over the steering wheel.
He wanted to be there for a while.
We knew that there was a ticking clock on Jim Harbaugh the first second that he arrived. And I'm just glad that he stuck around long enough to leave it.
He got the national championship, and I'm sure you guys would do it 100 times again.
And I said it the other day, you being intimately aware of the city and its sports facilities, you know of that lake that's in front of SoFi. I believe he walked across it to sign the contract with the Los Angeles Chargers.
And I think he's going to do a great job for the Chargers.
By the way, already, I mean, there's already some buzz about all of that, too.
100%. I mean, look, he's a winner. He has proven he's a winner. And I think by obviously total fluke, him missing those 3 games in the year and having Sharon Moore be there what a great opportunity to say, oh, you know what? This guy is ready to be our head coach if it ever happens. And it happened. And I think Michigan will not miss a beat.
I hope so.
I mean, you have to replace a quarterback. But
no, I know that. We're working on it. I already see some video from spring practice. It's all very exciting. So what happens here with college football then? Like, what is the answer? I mean, there has to be an answer. This just can't keep going on the way that it's going on. And I know, obviously, with television contracts, it can, and money's flowing, it can. But it just seems to me that there has to be, and every coach wants some sort of rules. I don't think everybody's like, the kids shouldn't, well, there's probably some of that said kids shouldn't be paid at all, which is, I think, ridiculous. But there's got to be something that can be done. What is it?
Look, I think what you're going to have to do is the conference commissioners, really the Big Ten, the SEC, the ACC, and the Big 12, are going to have to say, look, football's great and we can make a lot of money organizing college football in a different kind of way.
Yes.
But if we're doing that and it's not benefiting all the other student athletes, we're missing the mark here and we're not doing our job and we're not actually serving the universities. I mean, UCLA, we're proud of all those athletes and student athletes who do incredible things.
And the history of it, my goodness.
It's incredible. And so we're going to miss that. If they don't take that ownership of that responsibility and embrace it, they're going to be the ones who get blamed for it. And the system right now is totally screwed. So to your point, The guy at Utah gave every football player a pickup truck, right? Some car dealer gave every player a football truck. Mm-hmm. But if Kyle Whittingham gives the quarterback a ride home because it's snowing to his dorm, it's an NCAA violation. It's like the system is ass backwards. And you've got to create a level playing field on the payment. You can't have just unlimited pay, because what you see is it's going to rip apart locker rooms, and it's going to rip apart culture, and it's going to rip apart what makes college athletics special. Because if it's professional football, and sort of the Caitlin Clark conversation people have been having is, if Caleb Williams really made $10 million at USC, does he really have to, you know, if USC is now essentially professional football,
yes,
does he really have to ever leave USC? It's, I mean, it sounds crazy, but it's not so crazy.
Well, I mean, it's going to be like old school, though, right?
Well,
it'll be like Will Ferrell showing up, you know, at age 48.
But if you're, if you're a University of Michigan, cannot operate a professional football team.
No, I understand that that's the construct of it. That's why we got to get everyone together. And I don't know if it is Greg Sankey. I flat out, when he zoomed in, flat out said, can you be commissioner? And he laughed, you know, and I'm sure there's Tony Petitti at the Big Ten. And because these are major television entities now.
Massive.
Okay. I mean, major. I mean, look at the number that ESPN just signed with the college football playoff for it, that number is insane.
Like, insane.
The NFL is probably the only bigger deal that they have got.
Per
right?
game, the cost per game.
Right.
The NFL is the only thing that generates more revenue per game than those 14 team playoffs.
That's it. Right. So that's where this has now gotten. And so the question is somebody's got to get together, and then we got to figure out which schools are involved, which schools are in, which aren't, and then figure out which schools that aren't could potentially play into it. Some sort of relegation similar to what we see over in Europe.
I completely agree. I actually think the NFL has an opportunity to be a real leader here, because if you think about it from the NFL's perspective, let's say there's only 64 teams or 48, pick your number, playing real Division I, whatever you want to call it, football.
Correct.
You've lost half of your developmental system if you're the NFL, from 110 to 64. That's not good for the business of the NFL.
Right.
And you've also now essentially empowered a competitor. I mean, you may not want to think of it as a competitor, but if you take those 48 teams and they only play each other, does the NFL really want USC Michigan on a Thursday night against a New Orleans Tampa Bay game? Not anything wrong with New Orleans Tampa Bay, but USC Michigan is a pretty powerful game. Notre Dame Texas, you know, like,
listen, you know who you're talking to, right? You know there's a roof over my head, and I love being an NFL guy.
Yes.
But there are some college football rivalries that over a team, two teams that, say, in late October are three games under 500 apiece.
It's not even close.
It would be a dicey battle.
And so
battle
I actually think the
ratings.
NFL can be a leader and say, look, the economics of college football need to change and be recognition of the money that's created and the value that the players drive. But let's not lose sight of the value that college football can support the entire ecosystem.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually think the NFL can say, look, we can help solve the problem, not take control of college football, but sort of create the pathway.
Yes.
And use that as a means to save all these Olympic sports that are good for this country. And by the way, the other thing, think about Paris Olympics this summer. There'll be 100 athletes competing in Paris for countries not the United States, mm-hmm. who went to college for free and got their athletic training at American universities. We train our competitors. Talk about power and soft power and the met. Like, that's a powerful thing. All those things are going to go away if we don't fix this problem.
So you think the NFL could be the entity to actually come in and
push the institutions to do what's right to maintain the sanctity of non-football sports? I think the NFL has a real opportunity to be a leader in that movement.
Oh, man. You got one more segment?
I do.
Okay, Casey Wasserman. Because you mentioned Caitlin Clark, I want to hit that. And then this is just a fascinating conversation. I literally could talk about this all day. Casey Wasserman, the chairman and CEO of Wasserman, back here on the Rich Eisen Show in a second.
Our house is a mess. Come on in.
I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wallen.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
back here on the show. What do you ever have a memory of Jerry Buss?
Yeah.
When'd you first meet him? When you were a teenager or something like that?
Yeah, I met him when I was a teenager, and he was like, the one thing I always loved about like watching him is he wasn't the owner who sat on the floor. He sat way up in the back at the forum. Mm-hmm. Maybe he didn't want to be seen what was going on, but he sat way back up in the forum. And if you just think about like successful owners,
yeah,
he hired incredible people, and for the most part, he'd let them do their thing. And the one thing I heard him say, he told me this, what he realized, and it sort of came out in that Winning Time show.
Yeah.
He says, this is LA, and when people come to visit LA, they want to see celebrity. But you, like, where would you go? If someone came to visit you, where would you say to go? You don't even know where you'd say to go, except a Lakers game. He wanted to make sure that you could always see a celebrity because he knew in LA that that would be the special attraction. And to this day, it's true. If you want to see a celebrity and someone comes to LA, the best place to tell them to go is a Lakers game. And it's actually a pretty crazy, powerful thing he figured out.
And you know where to find him.
Exactly.
Put him right there on the
Correct.
Floor.
It's genius.
And so when they also televise it, they see who's
Correct.
Sitting right
and
it, there.
So the attraction of the Lakers is unique and special. And he figured that out before I think anybody realized the power of celebrity.
He told you that? He like literally said that to you?
He literally said, I knew that people want to see him, and I knew that we had to be the place to go see him, and it was something that no one else could do.
Because I guess, did they create Celebrity Row, essentially?
Essentially.
I mean, because I know Madison Square Garden, when the Knicks were winning, you know, there's Dustin Hoffman,
Correct.
There's Woody Allen,
but
or whatever.
The Lakers were the first.
Yeah, right there in the old forum. Man, which is now, I'm going to see Bruce Springsteen there in a couple weeks. It's kind of crazy what
it
the
is
hell
crazy.
That's become. This whole
it is
scene.
Weird. When you walk back in there, I went to see Madonna, and you walk back in there, you're like,
yeah, where's the James Worthy banners? You're looking for them. I don't even know if they're probably not there anymore, obviously.
No, they're not
back
there.
Here on the Rich Eisen Show, Casey Wasserman still here. So you mentioned in our conversation the Caitlin Clark deal that's on the table from Cube for the Big Three, $5 million for her to do that. Is there a way for her to do that and the WNBA, do you think?
I mean, practically probably.
Right.
What I would say is she's a bit of a unicorn, so I'm sure she can make $5 million off the court as part of the WNBA from endorsement.
She can do that.
I do believe she's that big an athlete and that big a star right now. And I think what she will embrace is she has the ability to elevate the WNBA in a way maybe no athlete ever has. For as incredible as some of these WNBA players in the first 25 years have been, and is Diana Taurasi the greatest women's basketball player ever, Caitlin Clark at this moment in time, if Diana Taurasi was Caitlin Clark, it would be Diana Taurasi today. But Caitlin Clark today, given what has happened the last 5 or 6 years around women's sports and the energy and the momentum, she can transform that league. And the economics of that and the reputational benefit of that and the legacy part of that is going to be actually incredibly powerful. And I think she will embrace that and not just chase $5 million for the Big Three. I give them credit for making the offer, because what it really is pointing out is Caitlin Clark's making more money as playing at University of Iowa than she's going to make as a rookie in the WNBA.
She is? I mean, you obviously are intimately knowledgeable of these figures in this world. So
I mean, absolutely. Now, the endorsements and some of the other things will sort of make up a lot of that. But absolutely, it's why we represent Brittany Griner. It's why they all go off to go play in some of these other countries, in China, not anymore, but Russia, not anymore, but Turkey and some of these other countries where women go play basketball is because the opportunity. And I think one of the things that the NBA deserves credit for is they've continued to invest in the WNBA. And I think you're at a turning point where the economics of the WNBA are going to be remarkable.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was misconstruing. Yes, I understand she's making more NIL at Iowa than she would make salary with the WNBA. But,
correct.
She could make more money as a WNBA player than she is currently at Iowa, do you think, in terms of off the court?
I think she might have more restrictions to the WNBA than she made at Iowa. I mean, it'll be interesting, you know, like.
No kidding.
Yeah, she won't. Look.
Because there's official sponsors and things of that nature.
And look, let's be honest about NIL. NIL, you know, as an endorsement, there's economic rationale for a company to spend that. Some of the NIL money is not based on rational economics, on irrational excitement about University of Iowa for her. And so it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting switch to flip for her when she goes from being an amateur getting money for whatever to a professional getting money for very specific purposes. And, you know, she's got to have a lot more obligations on her time.
Just because I want to have your back, when you say irrational, you're not saying people are irrational for loving Iowa. You mean rabid. You mean rabid love for Iowa Hawkeye program.
Non-economic spending for players. How about that?
I don't want to get you in trouble with the nation's heartland, sir.
No, I think, I look, I, you know, it was great.
I know that.
We enjoy playing. We'll enjoy going there in the Big Ten, right? I mean, come on, we're ready.
We're ready. You've been in the Big Ten for 2 seconds.
I don't even think we're in yet, actually. I mean, I don't know when our first game. I think football's probably.
It's because the Pac-12 is still
the
Pac. Well, but the Pac-12 is
in the tournament. Correct.
They play in the tournament.
Correct. You had to rub that in. Both of our teams aren't there, so I understand that.
So Caitlin Clark, because when I was there at the combine in late February is when she it was apparent that she was going to be in a WNBA player,
yeah,
and that they're going to get her because they're in Indianapolis. They've got the first overall pick. People were jammed. They were psyched. They were fired up. They were talking about it.
It's
in
remarkable.
Bars and stuff like that.
It's remarkable, and she is the talent in the women's game has changed dramatically. By the way. The women's game is, you might be able to name more stars in the women's game today than you could in the men's game.
Hey, man, if I was given a choice of watching South Carolina LSU, or, you know, in women's compared to, you know, obviously a diehard rivalry right now in men's, I would choose the women's game right now.
I agree.
I would absolutely want to watch. I can't wait to see. I hope they play each other again. You know, I would. My daughter, after she won, I should say, Taylor won her All-Star competition. Yes, her tournament. We went home and watched Caitlin Clark's first round game. And even, you know, her first quarter, she didn't do very well. No. So, you know.
But think about, I mean, Kiki Rice and Angel Reese and Paige Becker, they're superstars. Mm-hmm. And if they all end up, the women's Final Four this year could be, in some ways, it depends on who the men bigger than the men's tournament.
Casey Wasserman here on the Rich Eisen Show. Okay, so before I let you go, which sport, name it, would you say has got the biggest growth potential over the next 10 years? What do you think?
Football, soccer, I would say still, because I think you're going to, just like the NFL has done an incredible job of taking their games overseas, real games overseas, mm-hmm. I think you're going to start to see European professional football games played in the United States. It is the biggest sport in the world,
mm-hmm.
and this is the biggest sports market in the world. And I think that is a big upside. I mean, look at what Messi playing for MLS is doing for MLS. It's stunning. But if you had a Manchester United-Chelsea match in New York, and you had a Real Madrid-Barcelona match in Miami, and you had those level of games in American cities like
that,
the NFL,
count.
They're real games.
Right.
That could be massive. And I think the other thing.
Is that going to happen?
I would be shocked if it didn't. There's a lot of, you know, soccer is very. The emotion around soccer, as you saw with the Super League, is unlike most American sports, right? Mm-hmm. We get upset if a team moves, but this was a whole other level. So they're going to have to work through those things. The other thing is, I do think the NBA, because it's such a global sport, is going to have a real opportunity to continue. The Olympics this summer will be interesting. You know, the best player, essentially the best player in the world is not American at the Olympics this summer, right? It's Jokic.
Mm-hmm.
You wake up in 4 years, because this is our last team with Steph and LeBron. These guys are in 2028. I mean, I hope the U.S. wins a gold medal this summer, but I'm not sure you'd bet on that.
Mm-hmm.
And 2028, think about the way the NBA is going, their international reach and the power of that.
Yes.
Sport to reach people all over the world and be an accessible sport to play, that's a big opportunity and going to continue to grow. But soccer is massive, and its ability to exploit and take advantage of markets that it's not in today is pretty extraordinary. And I think that'll be I think you're going to see a lot of it.
45-year-old LeBron will be playing for the Los Angeles in the Los Angeles
Olympics. I would like
Olympics.
Him to play in Los Angeles. That would be thrilling like for me to have.
Like the Tom Brady version of LeBron.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
He doesn't have to play a whole lot. He could just come, you know, thing and intimidate and do his thing, right? And whatever.
You just need what? You just need
a dozen minutes, right?
That's it. Yeah. 12 minutes.
Yeah.
I think a 45-year-old LeBron will give you that.
I agree. 84, Bobby Knight was the coach. Michael Jordan played.
Dude. We were talking about that with we were talking about the dream team with Christian Laettner the other day, like what he must have been.
Can you imagine being him on that team?
I know. He was saying, you know, like he just walked in and he didn't say a word.
I'm sure he did.
Which is one of the few times for him.
And I'm sure they didn't talk to him.
To actually do that. And so in the last 2 minutes I have with you left, the first celebrity sighting of your life, your grandfather brought you around. What do you remember?
First celebrity sighting of my life. That's a good question. I will tell you one of the coolest celebrity sightings. I can't remember the first because now I'm getting old. But the coolest one, I was in Europe with England with my grandfather. Mm-hmm. and someone yells, Lou, Lou, and I turn around and it's Don Shula. And he had just won 325.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, wow. Don Shula was like saying hi to my grandfather. That was cool to
Come
me.
Come on,
like,
man. I thought it would be Nicholson. It would be, you know.
Look, I grew up around Hollywood, so I want to know the sports stars. Like, okay. I have the story that when I went to Wimbledon, I made my grandfather introduce me to Phil Knight because I was obsessed with Nike and Phil Knight.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandfather was like, why is that guy wearing shorts and a straw hat when we're all in suits and ties? And I was like, that's because he's Phil Knight. He's the coolest guy in the world. So, like, I wanted to meet the athletes and the things. I didn't want to meet the celebrities. So
Don Shula.
I mean, just...
I wouldn't think that would be the answer, but okay.
I know, but Don Shula was, like, a legendary guy.
I know that.
I mean, no one probably remembers who he is. You know, I don't know.
That's not true. Just yesterday, we had Rich McKay of the competition committee on. Yeah. And I'm trying to get the rule change in the NFL, fumbling through the end zone goes, you know, the ball goes to the defense. I think that's a terrible rule. I think that's going to happen in a Super Bowl one day at the end of a game, and half this country is going to go, what the hell was that? And I'm trying to head things off at the pass because, again, there's an eye, Rich and Eisen. I'm a team player.
Yeah.
So I said to him, you know, what gives? Because I thought this was some momentum this year to change the rule. And he said, there's no momentum to change the rule. And he went back to back in the day at the competition committee when Don Shula would say, just don't fumble the ball. There's one person who could control whether it's fumbled through the end zone. And it's the ball carrier. And I'm like, well, damn it. Like, how can I fight Don Shula, the ghost of Don Shula?
Do we like the kickoff rule?
I do like it, actually.
I think it'd be cool.
I think it's going to be working out. Hey, it's better than whatever.
I was a Cleveland Browns ball boy, by the way. I was. I lived in Cleveland for a summer. I was 12 years old. I was a ball boy. Bernie Kosar, Webster Slaughter, Clay Matthews. The heyday of the Browns. I was a Browns ball boy.
Who knew that about Casey Wasserman? I had no idea. So
still have my paycheck for $100. I never cashed it.
By the way, $100, is that? I would think it would be less than that. Was that the full season?
Well, that was a full summer. Yeah.
Okay, full summer. Okay.
Art Modell.
So is his name on the check?
Sign the check.
An Art Modell check.
It is hanging in my office.
It is that.
My first job.
Being a ball boy for the Cleveland Browns.
Yep.
Okay. And Kosar was a good dude.
Kosar was a good dude. My favorite thing was, they don't do this anymore, I don't think, but during two-a-days, they'd have all the guys would have to come in and weigh before and after every practice.
Yeah.
And it was a manual scale, and there was this chart on the wall where you filled in a thing. And so I was... to like step on the scale, and I'd write the thing next to the player. They all obviously had weight clauses. So he comes and he goes, I'm 280. And I look at him, I'm like, you know, I'm a 12-year-old. I'm like, but you didn't step on the scale. He goes, I'm 280, kid. I'm like, yes, sir, 280. I learned who was boss.
There must have been some clause in the contract as well, right?
I mean, I was a little short Jewish kid from Beverly Hills. I was just saying yes, sir, and it was over. Whatever they wanted.
So let's be honest. Lou called up Art. Old friends. They're probably Mishpoka from back in the day.
They were Mishpoka. I will tell you that Art Modell spent all of May and June in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. It's better than Cleveland in May and June. And he was really good friends with my grandparents. And Art knew I was obsessed with sports and said, you know what? So I actually lived with Art and Pat Modell in their house. And he drove me to training camp in Berea every day and picked me up on the way home. And I spent a summer with the Browns.
You're the man. Thanks for coming on, Casey.
Thanks for having me.
Casey Wasserman here on the Rich Eisen Show. Hour 3 coming up.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.